Chapter 26. Unlike most high-level government officials or corporate executive officers, Admiral James Sandecker always arrived for a meeting first. He preferred to be settled in with his data files and prepared to direct the conference in an efficient manner. It was a practice he had established when commanding fleet operations in the Navy. Although he had a large conference room at his disposal for visiting dignitaries, scientists, and government officials, he favored a smaller workroom next to his office for private and close-knit meetings. The room was a shelter within a shelter for him, restful and mentally stimulating. A 12-foot conference table stretched across a turquoise carpet, surrounded by plush leather chairs. The table had been crafted from a piece of the hull from a 19th-century schooner that had lain deep beneath the waters of Lake Erie. The richly paneled mahogany wall displayed a series of paintings depicting historic naval sea battles. Sandecker ran NUMA like a benevolent dictator, with a firm hand, and loyal to his employees to a fault. Personally picked by a former president to form the National Underwater and Marine Agency from scratch, he had built a far-reaching operation with 2,000 employees that scientifically probed into every peak and valley under the seas. NUMA was highly respected around the world for its scientific projects, and its budget requests were rarely denied by Congress. An exercise fanatic, he maintained a 62-year-old body that knew no fat. He stood a few inches over 5 feet and stared through hazel eyes, surrounded by flaming red hair and a Van Dyke beard. An occasional drinker, mostly at Washington dinner parties, his only major sin was a fondness for elegant cigars, grand and aromatic, that were personally selected and wrapped to his exacting specifications by a small family in the Dominican Republic. He never offered one to visitors, but was irritated and frustrated to extremes because he often caught Giordino smoking the exact same cigars and yet could never find any of his private stock missing. He was sitting at the end of the table and stood as Pitt and Pat O'Connell stepped into the room. He stepped forward and greeted Pitt like a son, shaking his hand while gripping a shoulder.
"Good to see you."
"Always a pleasure to be back in the fold again," Pitt replied, beaming. The Admiral was like a second father to him, and they were very close. Sandecker turned to Pat.
"Please sit down, Doctor. I'm anxious to hear what you and Hiram have for me."
Giordino and Jaeger soon joined the others, followed by Dr. John Stevens, a noted historian and author of several books on the study and identification of ancient artifacts. Stevens was an academic and looked the part, complete with a sleeveless sweater under a wool sport coat that had a meerschaum pipe protruding from the breast pocket. He had a way of cocking his head like a robin listening for a worm under the sod. He carried a large plastic ice chest, which he set beside his chair on the carpet. Sandecker set the sawed-off base of an 8-inch shell casing from a naval gun in front of him as an ashtray and lit up a cigar. He stared at Giordino, half expecting his project specialist to light up too. Giordino decided not to irritate his boss and did his best to look cultured. Pitt could not help noticing that Jaeger's and Pat's faces seemed unduly strained and tired. Sandecker opened the discussion by asking if they'd all had a chance to go over the report from Pat and Jaeger. All nodded silently except Giordino.
"I found it interesting reading," he said, "but as science fiction it doesn't measure up to Isaac Asimov or Ray Bradbury."
Jaeger gave Giordino a steady gaze.
"I assure you, this is not science fiction."
"Have you discovered what this race of people called themselves?" asked Pitt. "Did their civilization have a name besides Atlantis?" Pat opened a file on the desk in front of her and pulled out a sheet of notebook paper and peered at the writing.
"As near as I can decipher and translate into English, they referred to their league of seafaring city-states as Amenes."
"Amenes," Pitt repeated slowly. "It sounds Greek."
I unraveled a number of words that could well be the origins for later Greek and Egyptian language terms.
Sandecker gestured the end of his cigar at the historian. Dr. Stevens, I assume you've examined the obsidian skulls?
I have.
Stevens leaned down, opened the ice chest, lifted out one of the black skulls, and set it upright on a large silk pillow laid on the conference table. The glossy obsidian gleamed under the overhead spotlights.
A truly remarkable piece of work, he said reverently. Amini's artisans began with a solid block of obsidian, one that was incredibly pure of imperfections, a rarity in itself. Over a period of at least 90 to 100 years, and perhaps more, the head was shaped by hand, using what I believe was obsidian dust as a smoothing agent.
"Why not some type of hardened metal chisels tapped by a mallet?" asked Giordino.
Stevens shook his head. No tools were wielded. There are no signs of scratches or nicks. Obsidian, though extremely hard, is very prone to fracture. One slip, one misplaced angle of a chisel, and the whole skull would have shattered. No, the shaping and polishing had to be accomplished as if a marble bust had been delicately smoothed by car polish.
How long would it take to reproduce with modern tools?
Stevens gave a faint grin.
Technically, it would be next to impossible to create an exact replica. The more I study it, the more I become convinced it shouldn't exist.
Are there any markings on the base to suggest a source? Asked Sandecker.
No markings, answered Stevens. But let me show you something that's truly astonishing.
With extreme care, he slowly made a twisting motion as he lifted the upper half of the skull until it came free. Next, he removed a perfectly contoured globe from the skull cavity. Holding it devoutly in both hands, he lowered it onto a specially prepared cushioned base.
I can't begin to imagine the degree of artistic craftsmanship it took to produce such an astonishing object, he said admiringly. Only while studying the skull under strong magnification did I see a line around the skull plate that was invisible to the naked eye. It's absolutely fabulous, murmured Pat in awe.
Are there carvings on the globe? Pitt asked Stevens.
Yes. It's an engraved illustration of the world. If you care to view it more closely, I have a magnifying glass.
He handed the thick glass to Pitt, who peered at the lines inscribed on the globe that was about the size of a baseball. After a minute, he carefully slid the globe across the table in front of Sandecker and passed him the magnifying glass. While the Admiral was examining the globe, Stevens said,
By comparing the photographs taken inside the chamber in Colorado with those from St. Paul Island, I found that the continents perfectly match those of the obsidian globe.
Meaning? Asked Sandecker.
If you study the alignment of the continents and large islands such as Greenland and Mozambique, you'll find they don't match the geography of the world today.
I observed the differences too, said Pitt.
What does that prove? Asked Giordino, playing the role of skeptic. Except that it's a primitive, inaccurate map.
Primitive, yes. Inaccurate? Perhaps by modern standards. But I strongly support the theory that these ancient peoples sailed every sea on earth and charted thousands of miles of coastlines. If you look closely at the obsidian globe, you can see they even defined Australia, Japan, and the Great Lakes of North America. All this by people who lived more than 9,000 years ago.
Unlike the Atlantis that was described by Plato as having existed on a single island or continent, Pat spoke up, the Amines engaged in worldwide commerce. They went far beyond the bounds of much later civilizations. They were not restricted by tradition or fear of the unknown seas. The inscriptions detail their sea routes and vast trading network that took them across the Atlantic and up the St. Lawrence River to Michigan,
where they mined copper, and to Bolivia and the British Isles, where they mined tin, using advanced developments in metallurgy to create and produce bronze, thereby lifting mankind from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age.
Sandecker leaned across the table. Surely they mined and traded in gold and silver.
Strangely, they did not consider gold or silver useful metals, and preferred copper for their ornaments and artworks. But they did journey around the world in search of turquoise and black opal, which they fashioned into jewelry, and, of course, obsidian, which was almost sacred to them. Obsidian, by the way, is still used in open-heart surgery, because it has a sharper edge that causes less tissue damage than steel.
Both turquoise and black opal were represented on the mummies we found in the burial chamber, added Giordino.
Which demonstrates the extent of their reach, said Pat. The rich robin's egg blue I saw in the chamber could only have come from the American Southwest deserts.
And the black opal? Asked Sandecker.
Australia.
If nothing else, said Pitt thoughtfully, it confirms that the Amenes had knowledge of nautical science and learned to build ships capable of sailing across the seas thousands of years ago.
It also explains why their communities were built as port cities, Pat summed up. And according to what was revealed by the photographs in the burial chamber, few societies in the history of man were so far-flung. I've located over 20 of their port cities in such diverse parts of the world as Mexico, Peru, India, China, Japan, and Egypt. Several of them are in the Indian Ocean, and a few on islands of the Pacific.
I can back up Dr. O'Connell's findings with my own on the globes from the skull, said Stevens. So their world was not based around the Mediterranean, as later civilizations were, said the Admiral.
Stevens gave a negative shake of his head.
The Mediterranean was not open to the sea during the Amenes era. 9,000 years ago, the Med, as we know it, was made up of fertile valleys and lakes fed by European rivers to the north and the Nile to the south, which merged and then flowed through the Straits of Gibraltar into the Atlantic. You might also be interested in knowing that the North Sea was a dry plain and the British Isles were part of Europe. The Baltic Sea was also a broad valley above sea level. The Gobi and Sahara deserts were lush, tropical lands that supported huge herds of animals. The ancient ones lived on a planet very different from the one we live on.
What happened to the Amenes? Asked Sandecker. Why hasn't evidence of their existence come down to us before now?
Their civilization was utterly destroyed when a comet struck the Earth around 7,000 BC and caused a worldwide cataclysmic disaster. That's when the land bridge from Gibraltar to Morocco was breached and the Mediterranean became a sea. Shorelines were inundated and changed forever. Within the time it takes for a raindrop to fall from a cloud, the sea people, their cities, and their entire culture were erased from the earth and lost until now.
You deciphered all that from the inscriptions?
That and more, Jaeger answered earnestly. They described the horror and suffering in vivid detail. The impact of the comet was gigantic, sudden, appalling, and deadly. The inscriptions go on to tell of mountains shaking like willows in a gale. Earthquakes shook with a magnitude that would be inconceivable today. Volcanoes exploded with the combined force of thousands of nuclear bombs, filling the sky with layers of ash 100 miles thick. Pumice blanketed the seas as dense as 10 feet. Rivers of lava buried most of what we call the Pacific Northwest. Fires spread under hurricane-like winds, creating towering clouds of smoke that blanketed the sky. Tidal waves, perhaps as much as 3 miles high, swept over the land. Islands vanished, buried under water for all time. Most of the people, and all but a handful of animals and sea life, disappeared in a time span of 24 hours.
Giordino put his hands behind his head and looked up at the ceiling, trying to picture in his mind the terrible devastation.
So that explains it. The sudden extinction in the Americas of the saber-toothed tiger, the humped-back camel, the musk oxen, that giant bison with a horn spread of 6 feet, the woolly mammoth, the small shaggy horse that once roamed the plains of North America, and the instant turning to stone of clams, soft jellyfish, oysters, and starfish. You remember we discovered them during projects coring under the sediments. These discrepancies have always been an enigma to scientists. Now maybe they can tie it to the comet's impact.
Sandecker stared at Giordino with an appraising look in his eyes. The short Etruscan possessed a brilliant mind, but worked to conceal it behind a sardonic wit.
Stevens pulled out his pipe and toyed with it.
It's well known in the scientific community that mass global extinctions of animals weighing over 100 pounds occurred in unison with the end of the last ice age, about the same time as the comet's impact.
Mastodons were found preserved by ice in Siberia, the food undigested in their stomach, establishing the fact that they died quite suddenly, almost as if sent into an instant deep freeze. The same with trees and plants that were found frozen while in leaf and in bloom.
The degree of horror could not be completely imagined by anyone sitting at the table. The scope was simply too enormous for them to conceive.
"I'm not a geophysicist," said Stevens quietly, "but I cannot believe that a comet striking the Earth, even a large one, could cause such tremendous destruction on such a massive scale. It's inconceivable."
65 million years ago, a comet or asteroid killed off the dinosaurs, Giordino reminded him.
"It must have been one enormous comet," said Sandecker.
"Comets can't be measured like asteroids or meteors that have a solid mass," Jaeger lectured. "Comets are a composite of ice, gas, and rocks."
Pat continued reciting the story of the inscriptions without reading from her notes.
"Some of the inhabitants of Earth who survived lived, farmed, and hunted in the mountains and high plains. They were able to escape the aftermath of horror by going underground or hiding in caves, existing on whatever pitiful vegetation and flora that could revive and grow under unhealthy conditions, along with the few animals left to hunt. Many died of starvation or from the gaseous clouds smothering the atmosphere. Only a scant handful of the Amines, who happened to be on high ground during the tidal waves, survived."
"The story of what has come down to us as the deluge," clarified Stevens, "has been recorded by Sumerian tablets dating back 5,000 years in Mesopotamia. The legend of Gilgamesh and the flood predates the biblical story of Noah and the Ark. Stone records of the Mayans, written records by Babylonian priests, legends handed down by every cultural race of the world, including the Indians throughout North America, all tell of a great inundation. So there is little doubt the event actually occurred."
"And now," said Jaeger, "thanks to the Amines, we have a date of approximately 7100 BC.
"History tells us that the more advanced the civilization," Stevens commented, "the more easily it will die and leave little or nothing of itself behind. At least 99% of the grand total of ancient knowledge has been lost to us through natural disasters and man's destruction."
Pitt nodded in agreement.
"A golden age of ocean navigation 7,000 years before Christ, but nothing to show for it but inscriptions in rock. A pity we can't have more to inherit from them."
Sandecker exhaled a cloud of blue smoke.
"I sincerely hope that won't be our fate."
Pat took over from Jaeger.
"Those who remained of the Amines formed a small cult and dedicated themselves to educating the remaining Stone Age inhabitants in arts and written communication, as well as teaching them how to construct substantial buildings and ships to sail the seas. They tried to warn future generations of another coming cataclysm, but those who came later and had not lived during the comet's destruction and horrible aftermath could not bring themselves to accept that such a traumatic episode from the past would repeat itself. The Aminis realized the awful truth would soon become lost in the mists of time, recalled only in a score of myths. So they attempted to leave a legacy by building great monuments of stone to last throughout the centuries, engraved with their message of the past and future. The great megalithic cult they created became widespread and lasted for 4,000 years. But time and the elements eroded the inscriptions and erased the warnings. After the Aminis finally died out, centuries of paralysis set in, before the Sumerians and Egyptians began to emerge from primitive cultures and gradually build new civilizations, using bits and pieces of the knowledge from the distant past. Pitt tapped a pencil on the table. From what little I know on the subject of megaliths, it would seem that later cultures, having lost the original intent of the Aminis through the centuries, used monumental structures as temples, tombs, and stone calendars, eventually building thousands of their own. In studying the available data on megaliths, said Jaeger, the very early structures show that the Aminis had a distinct form of architecture. Their style of building was mostly circular, with triangular-shaped stone blocks cut like interlocking pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, making them almost impervious to any movement of the earth, regardless of how severe. Stephen spoke very deliberately as he replaced the globe in its socket inside the black skull. Thanks to the efforts of Mr. Jaeger and Dr. O'Connell, it's beginning to look as if elements of the Aminis culture and ancient heritage were passed through the centuries and eventually absorbed by the Egyptians, Sumerians, the Chinese, and Olmecs, who preceded the Mayans, and both the Asian Indians and the American Indians. The Phoenicians, more than any other civilization, took up the torch of deep ocean navigation. Their revelations also help to explain why most of the gods and deities from nearly every later civilization in every part of the world came from the sea, and why all the gods setting foot in the Americas came from the east, while the gods appearing in the early European cultures came from the west. Sandecker stared at his cigar smoke spiraling to the ceiling. An interesting point, Doctor, that answers any number of questions about our ancient ancestors that we've puzzled over for hundreds of years. Pitt nodded at Pat. What finally happened to the last of the Aminis? Frustrated that their message would not be received and acted upon, they built chambers in different parts of the world that they hoped would not be found for thousands of years, and only then by future civilizations with the science to understand their message of danger. Which was? Prompted Sandecker. The date of the second comet's return to Earth's orbit, and the almost certain impact. Stevens wagged his finger to make a point. A recurring theme in mythology is that the cataclysm with its accompanying deluge will repeat itself.
Hardly a cheery thought, said Giordino. What made them so certain there would be another devastating visitor from outer space, wondered Sandecker.
The inscriptions describe in great detail two comets that arrived at the same time, answered Jaeger. One impacted, the other missed and returned to space.
Are you suggesting the Aminis could accurately predict the date of the second comet's return?
Pat simply nodded.
The Aminis, said Jaeger, were masters not only of the seas but of the heavens as well. They measured the movement of the stars with uncanny accuracy, and they did it without powerful telescopes.
Suppose the comet does come back, said Giordino. How could they know it wouldn't miss the Earth and sail off into the great beyond again? Was their science so sophisticated they could calculate the time of impact at the exact position of the Earth's orbit in space?
They could and did, Pat retorted. By computing and comparing the different positions of the stars and constellations between the ancient star map in the Colorado chamber
with present astronomical star positions, we were able to arrive at our own date and time.
It matched the Amini's prediction within an hour.
The Egyptians devised a double calendar that's far more intricate than what we use today. The Mayans measured the length of the year at 365.2420 days. Our calculation using atomic clocks is 365.2423. They also computed incredibly accurate calendars based on the conjunctions of Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The Babylonians determined the sidereal year at 365 days, 6 hours, and 11 minutes. They were off by 2 seconds.
Pat paused for effect.
The Amini's computation for the Earth circuit of the Sun was off by 0.2 seconds. They based their calendar on a solar eclipse that occurred on the same day of the year at the same site on the zodiac every 521 years. Their celestial map of the heavens, as observed and calculated 9,000 years ago, was right on the money.
"The question on all our minds now," said Sandecker, "is at what point in time did the Amini's predict the reappearance of the comet?"
Pat and Jaeger exchanged sober looks. Jaeger spoke first.
"We learned from a computer search of ancient archaeoastronomy files and papers from the archives of several universities that the Amini's were not the only ancient astronomers to predict a second doomsday. The Mayans, the Hopi Indians, the Egyptians, the Chinese, and several other pre-Christian civilizations all came up with dates for the end of the world. The disturbing part is that, collectively, they arrived within a year of each other."
"Could it be simply a coincidence or one culture borrowing from another?"
Jaeger shook his head doubtfully.
"It's possible they copied what was passed on by the Amini's, but indications are that their studies of the stars only confirmed the impact time passed on by those they considered as ancients."
"Who do you think were the most accurate in their prediction?" asked Pitt.
"Those of the Amini's who survived, because they were present during the actual catastrophe. They predicted not only the year, but the exact day."
"Which is?" Sandecker prompted expectantly.
Pat sank in her chair as if retreating from reality. Jaeger hesitated, looking around the table from face to face. At last he said in a halting voice,
"The time the Amini's predicted the comet would return and shatter the Earth is May 20th, in the year 2001.
Pitt frowned. "This is 2001.
Jaeger massaged his temples with both hands.
"I'm well aware of that."
Sandecker hunched forward.
"Are you saying Doomsday is less than 2 months away?"
Jaeger nodded solemnly.
"Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying."